wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this August 31st Monday. And a big thank you to the dedicated KBOO staff who over the last months have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. Tomorrow, September 1st, kicks off our fall drive. All month, listeners, family, friends will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community, and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment, not just in trying times, but every day of the week, 24/7. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Lawrence Douglas, professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. They talk about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Last week in part one, they discussed why Trump will never concede, and if he appears to be losing this November, how he and his forces and base could create a constitutional and political crisis in order to hold on to power. In part two, Bill Resnick and Lawrence Douglas discuss how Trump can be stopped. Larry Bolden reviews Abi Dare's debut novel, The Girl with the Louding Voice, a story told from the perspective of Aduni, a young Nigerian woman trapped in a life of servitude, but determined to fight for her dreams and choose her own future. This review is read by Patricia Kohlberg. Desiree Halligers interviews playwright and activist organizer Donna Hayes about her new play, Silent Voices, which depicts the stories of nine people, including her grandson, Quanis Hayes, who were killed by Portland police. They also talk about Donna Hayes' role in organizing the PDX car caravan protesting police violence. We'll conclude this morning's program from the archive, June 2019. The late Clayton Morgridge reads his commentary based on Martin Hegland's book, This Life, Secular Life and Spiritual Freedom. Quote, life is short and fragile, which makes it precious. Capitalism wastes and abuses our time, while socialism can make our time our own. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Lawrence Douglas.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick again. Last week I talked to Lawrence Douglas, who teaches law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. Talked about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. We discussed in part one of our interview last week how he will never concede defeat. After all, he's not a loser. He acknowledges he went bankrupt five times, but then says, I made money on each one. What about the workers, construction workers, and small business vendors who got paid pennies on the dollar? Well, he doesn't worry about that. Still, he won't concede. He may be forced out if he loses the election by a huge margin. And then he'd have to hazard private life, where he would be subject to numerous investigations, especially in his business dealings and maybe sex life. And he's going to try to rally his base to protect him and maybe even run for president in 2024 after a failed Biden administration. That's likely. That's one set of scenarios. More likely, the election will be close. He is counting on that, counting on it being decided in the swing states. And he and his forces are doing everything in their power, if he's losing the election by a narrow margin, everything in their power to call on his base and the militias and his Second Amendment people, calling them to create mayhem in the streets. Then, of course, calling in the police to dominate the streets, particularly with Republican governors in many of the swing states. to dominate the streets in the cities, and in the cities where left protesters will not back down, he could well do what he rehearsed recently in Portland, call in the military. In that case, some sort of declaration of martial law. That's, of course, the worst-case scenario. I'm afraid it could well happen. My sense is that he really fears the humiliation that will come from all those investigations into his life as a big-time grifter. In the second part of the interview, we discuss how Trump can still be stopped and forced into the hazards of private life. First, I asked Lawrence Douglas how these various terrible scenarios can be short-circuited, how he sees Trump being stopped.
I think the surest way to short-circuit it is to hand him a decisive defeat. And that decisive defeat, the clearer it is early on, the better our nation will be. Because I do think that if he's handed a decisive defeat, that wouldn't be subject to weeks and weeks of litigation and haggling, then even if he doesn't concede, that is, again, even if he doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the defeat, he's not going to have a whole lot of wiggle room with respect to creating a genuine constitutional crisis. He might, again, encourage mayhem. He might, again, encourage people to take to the streets. But he's not going to be able to trigger a larger constitutional crisis. So one thing that people could do, first of all, is if they're not prepared to vote in person, which I completely understand, I think it would be important to send those mail-in ballots early, to really not wait to the last minute, because the larger the glut of mail-in ballots, the longer it's going to take to count them. And that is going to play in Trump's favor. So I think that's an absolutely essential thing to do. I mean, I do think also that if there are protests that demand that Trump recognize his defeat, that it is absolutely crucial for people to remain peaceful in their protesting. That, and maybe this goes without saying, but I do think that Trump, he doesn't want to quell violence with the use of federal agents. I think he wants to trigger it, and that would play to his into his game plan. So, you know, I think we have to rely on the democratic means that are within our hands, and the democratic means are get out and vote. And there might be a lot of people out there who would have liked to have seen a more progressive candidate for president than Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But my mind, at least, is this is kind of a code red moment for American democracy. And this is not a time to kind of sit there on the sidelines going, well, there really isn't that big a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Oh, there is. There is a huge difference. It is really clear in this election season. So basically my little two bits of wisdom, Bill.
This is Bill Resnick for our Old Mole Variety Hour Collective on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm talking to Lawrence Douglas about the themes of his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Last week, we discussed how Trump will try to steal the election. This week, we're discussing what must be done to stop him. Yeah, it seems to me that even before the election, and before his Second Amendment people are creating mayhem in the streets, and maybe agent provocateurs are prepared, even if the crowds are completely nonviolent and peaceful, and although determined and strong in their rejection of Trump, it seems to me that if we were able to get support before the election to do a march that carries all of the themes, that the votes have to be counted, that we all have to vote and vote quickly, that Trump is a real danger and he will likely reject a defeat, that we will not stand for it and have millions of people in the streets. That might send a signal, not to Trump or his base, they'll just dismiss them as fools that have been encouraged by the wily terrorists and communists to come into the streets. Trump will dismiss them, but the people who run things, that is, the corporate elite, as well as the military and maybe even the local police, although they're pretty unaccountable and have a lot of impunity all over this country, it seems to me that group and especially the military, will be strongly influenced to not cooperate with the Trumpies, and also put pressure on all those local legislators and governors, the Republicans, put pressure on them to cease their support for Trump. It seems to me that's a possible way of short-circuiting the Trump trajectory.
Yes, it's possible. You know, other things that I think could play a valuable role is I do think you could have citizens organize groups to make sure that there's no intimidation going on at polling places. Because I could imagine, for example, the administration trying to dispatch, let's say, ICE agents to areas in which people of, let's say, Latinx heritage are voting as an attempt to try to kind of chill them from exercising their right to vote. So I could imagine that also being an effective tool, let's say, on November 3rd, because I do think we just need to be extremely vigilant at this moment. And the more vigilant, peaceful, and committed we can be, then I think we increase the likelihood that this guy is going to be, at least will be forced to acknowledge that he has to leave office come noon on January 20th, 2021.
Yeah, one final thing. You discussed the struggle in Washington, D.C. when people in Lafayette Park and the protesters were very peacefully demonstrating. Trump had his Homeland Security people and very violently dispersed a very peaceful protest in front of a church and then do his photo op with his holding his Bible in front of this old church near the White House. That's when I think General Mattis, who was a highly respected military ranks, in any event, Mattis broke strongly with Trump and accused him of being the divisive and undemocratic. And he did a letter and an article in the press, widely circulated. And the letter was signed by many of the retired military officers that at the highest level, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the rest of them, of the generals. I think the Army does not want to get seen as the tool of one or another political faction or party. That may well carry the day, but maybe not with all of the commanders. I think the Army might, in fact, become an impediment to Trump's dreams.
Right. Well, I really have zero doubt that let's take a less ominous scenario, that Biden ultimately is sworn in on January 20th, so the nation knows that we have a freshly inaugurated president, and let's take a situation which I really don't imagine happening. I really don't imagine under those circumstances, after Biden has been inaugurated, that Trump would then just kind of barricade himself in the Oval Office. That I do not think is going to happen. At that point, who does the military follow? Do they follow Biden or do they follow Trump? And the answer, in my mind, is a no-brainer. They follow Biden. And not only do we have former Secretary Mattis coming out with really quite an astonishing statement that he published in the Atlantic Monthly, you know, accusing the president of basically dividing rather than uniting the American people. I think it's also was a pretty remarkable thing when General Mark Milley, you know, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that he apologized for appearing in the photo opportunity in that Lafayette Square incident. That I thought was quite an astonishing thing for him to actually kind of take to the airwaves and to issue a real apology. And this is another thing, you know, it's something I kind of mention in the book. I think at one point I described Trump as a weak authoritarian. And I say he's a weak authoritarian not because his instincts are kind of weakly authoritarian. I think they're pretty powerfully authoritarian. But I think one of the things that's pretty remarkable about him or about his presidency is it's typically the case that authoritarians work very hard to enlist the support of a nation's intelligence community and the senior military officers. that those are kind of the bedrock institutions of support of authoritarian. And it's really interesting the way in which Trump has completely alienated the leadership of the intelligence communities and of the military itself. I would believe that many of them consider Trump unfit for office, which is really quite a remarkable state of affairs.
Yeah, I'm worried about not the decision if Biden is sworn in. That's easy for the military. Their basic interest is just making sure that they keep a lion's share of the U.S. federal revenue, and Biden will surely be their friend, and they'll have no trouble with him. I'm worried about when Trump and his base have managed to create chaos in the cities, and Trump orders the military to protect all of the good citizens and bring law and order to the cities. Now, how will the military then react when Trump is president? After all, it could be a legal order. And even if it's not a strictly legal order, who's going to stop him if he gives them the order? What will they do then?
That's a source of a lot of concern, because I do think, as you point out, between November 3rd and January 20th at noon, he is still the commander-in-chief. And as much as the military leadership might consider him unfit for office, I don't see them countermanding order coming from the commander-in-chief unless it was, you know, transparently criminal order. Now, you could imagine them trying to kind of soft walk an order, you know, to kind of follow it in the kind of the least aggressive way possible. But I agree with you that you can't imagine them countermanding an order. In fact, on another level, you almost don't want them to. I mean, that's a whole other kind of world of hurt in a way when once the military starts deciding that an order of the commander is not to be followed. I mean, that's also one of those kind of precedents that you don't necessarily want to introduce into a nation in which the civilian is meant to be the highest military officer.
Well, we face a very uncertain future. You outlined that Lawrence Douglas is great service. Our nation really has to prepare, as you pointed out. Thanks a lot for talking to us today. I sure hope that you're going to be able to write about the ways in which the great majority of the American people managed to protect at least an electoral democracy. I think we have a long way to go before becoming a real, authentic, participatory democracy where most people are involved in making crucial decisions. Maintaining electoral democracy is also crucial. So, Lawrence Douglas, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure talking with you, Bill. I really appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
You too. Hi, folks. That's all for this interview. There just has to be a beginning, because we have to be very well prepared to deal with Trump in the run-up to the election. And it's only a couple of months plus a few days from today. And we also have to be able to deal with Trump's scheming and machinations using his base and Second Amendment people and the police and maybe the military. Trump's effort to stay in power in the 2.5 months after the election. That is, if it's a close election, and it is likely to be close. The big question is, of course, if Trump is on his way to stealing the election, will millions and millions of U.S. North Americans be ready to act in some sort of determined general strike and set of actions that put the elite and the army and the military on notice that Americans are not going to stand for a Trump theft, and they may be unwilling to act if he can somehow create a situation where it might be possible to get them to act. More on this and other questions about who rules this country on Cable and the Old Mole. Stay tuned and please contribute and donate to Cable Radio.
You just heard Bill Resnick interviewing Lawrence Douglas in part two of a two-part interview about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Both parts of this interview will be available on their website. Again, that's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Later in our program, we'll hear from Desiree Helligers, who interviews playwright and activist organizer Donna Hayes about her new play, Silent Voices, which depicts the stories of 9 people, including her grandson, Quanis Hayes, all who were killed by police in Portland. Next on The Old Mole, we have a review by Larry Bolden of Abe Dare's debut novel, The Girl with a Louding Voice. This review is read by Patricia Kohlberg.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg reading today for Book Mole, Larry Bolden. I want to talk to you today about a truly extraordinary debut novel by a Nigerian author. The title of the book is The Girl with the Louding Voice, and the name of this incredible new voice in literature is Abe Dare. The book won the Bath Novel Award for Unpublished Manuscripts in 2018, and fortunately for us readers, it was published in 2020. It is the story of a 14-year-old Nigerian girl, Aduni. When her mother dies young, her penniless father takes her out of school and sells her as a third wife to an old man. It had been her mother's dream that Aduni would stay in school and get an education. As her mother told her before she died, quote, "In this a village, if you go to school, no one will be forcing you to marry any man, but if you didn't go to school, they will marry you to any man once you are reaching 15 years old. Your schooling is your voice, child. It will be speaking till the day God is calling you home. That day, I tell myself that even if I am not getting anything in this life, I will go to school. I will finish my primary and secondary and university schooling and become a teacher, because I don't want to be having any kind of voice. I want a louding voice," end quote. Certainly, this poetic and lyrical novel is in a louding voice. It takes a bit of getting used to the verb tenses and expressions used, but within not many pages, what seemed awkward and difficult to follow becomes a marvelous look at the world through the eyes of a girl who wants, above all, to get an education. Her father, quote, "was telling me 3 years ago that I must stop my educations. That time, I was the most old of all in my class, and all the children's was always calling me auntie. I tell you true, the day I stopped school and the day my mama was dead is the worst day of my life," end quote. When her first old husband dies, she is sold again to a younger man and has to move to her husband's family house, where she is lorded over by a tyrannical mother-in-law. She escapes that house and husband and is secretly sold as a domestic servant to a wealthy household in Lagos. The woman of the house sells fabrics to other wealthy women. Aduni addresses her as Big Madame. She is subjected to the frequent rages of Big Madame and is always on guard against the lecherous advances of the shiftless man of the house. Fortunately, one of the servants, Abu, takes pity on the girl and manages to slip her food and aids her in other ways as well. Her dreams of an education seem doomed until she meets a progressive and enlightened Nigerian woman at one of Big Madame's parties. Ms. Tia slips books to Aduni and helps her with her English. Aduni is sure that if she can learn to speak good English, she will somehow, someday, be able to pursue her dreams of an education. The author, quite subtly, makes fun of the very notion of proper or good English, although it takes Aduni years to discover just how really good her English is. Miss Tia is from abroad, and while Aduni has little idea of what that is, She senses that it is the direction she needs to follow. Quote, I didn't too sure I understand what Ms. Tia is talking about or why she is calling her a broad people's white and black when colors are for crayons and pencils and things. I know that not everybody is having the same color of skin in Nigeria. Even me and Cayuse and Born Boy didn't have the same skin color. But nobody is calling anybody black or white. Everybody is just calling us by our names. Aduni, Cayuse, Born Boy, that's all. End quote. This wonderful book is peppered with what to me are amazing facts about Nigeria and its place in the world. In a short prologue to the novel, Dare tells her readers, quote, Nigeria is a country located in West Africa. With a population of just under 180 million people, it is the seventh most populous country in the world, which means that one in seven Africans is a Nigerian. As the sixth largest crude oil exporter in the world, and with a GDP of $568.5 billion, Nigeria is the richest country in Africa. Sadly, over 100 million Nigerians live in poverty, surviving on less than $1 a day. End quote. As I was looking over the book again yesternight, which is one of Aduni's many so logical uses of the language, I was swept away again by the passion of this louding voice and hoping I could do justice to the novel in reviewing it. Abi Dare succeeded in getting an education. She holds degrees in law, project management, and creative writing, and lives in the UK. Aduni is a character I will not forget. Her louding voice sings to me, whispers in my ear, and should give hope to many young girls all over the world who want to learn and to choose their own futures. I have been talking about Abi Dare's novel, The Girl with the Louding Voice. This is Patricia Kullberg reading once again for Larry Bolden and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Tangi dingi 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 tangi tangi, so yelly yelly. Tangi dingi 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 tangi tangi, so yelly yelly. So yelly yelly. So yelly yelly. Tangi dingi 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 tangi tangi, so yelly yelly. Sometimes the world has a load of questions. Seems like the world knows nothing at all. The world is near, but it's out of reach. Some people touch it, but it can hold on. She is moving to describe the world. She has messages for everyone. She is moving by remote control. Hands that move her are invisible.
You just heard Angélique Kidjo with a song that might probably sound a little bit familiar. That's The Talking Heads, and she re-recorded the entire album, Remain in Light, released by The Talking Heads in 1980. It is a fantastic interpretation of one of my very favorite albums, and I'm happy to have been able to have an opportunity to share a slice of that this morning. Before that, we heard Larry Bolden's review of Abi Dare's debut novel, The Girl with the Louding Voice, read by Patricia Kullberg. Of course, again, all of this will be found on our webpage, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, later in the week. Next, on The Old Mole, we have Desiree Helliger's interviewing playwright and activist organizer Donna Hayes about her new play, Silent Voices.
Last Sunday, I met up with Donna Hayes and her mother, Sylvia, in Northwest Portland's Cooch Park to talk about the debut of her new play, Silent Voices. In 2017, Donna Hayes' grandson, Quanis Hayes, known to his family as Moose, was shot and killed by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. He was unarmed and on his knees. Including Moose, the play depicts the stories of 9 people who were killed by the Portland police. The play was produced in collaboration with the Portland Playhouse and Open Signal, and with support from the Pacific Northwest Family Circle, an all-volunteer community group that supports Oregon and Washington families whose loved ones have been killed or injured by police officers. Donna Hayes, thank you so much for meeting with me today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
But can you tell me a little bit about the play that you wrote that's being released in September?
They were killed by police, and their stories needed to be told. It brings them back to life. So they get a chance to tell their stories, talk to their families.
Yeah, and your grandson Moose is one of those characters.
Yes. He was so easy to write about. Everybody else, I had family members I could talk to because Moose was the easiest to write. That was my favorite grandchild.
He would have just been 21 in August, is that right?
Yes, August 2nd would have been his birthday. I had promised him that I would take him to happy hour when he made 21. But needless to say, that didn't happen. And so my honor is the plate for him. And it got a chance to tell his story, the type of person he was. I'm part of Pacific Northwest Family Circle. They're a group of family members who lost their loved ones. People who I didn't know, I took newspaper articles, and I didn't take articles that where police was just beating them down. I took articles where families and friends talked about them. I didn't want the play to be all boo-hoo and I'm crying about everybody. I wanted it to be lively. I wanted people to know what was taken away from us. They were alive people, real people, and they was removed from us. I hated a lot of the newspapers' versions of these people. For instance, John Ellifritz. First thing they hollered out was that he was a white supremacist. I didn't like that. I know his wife. I talked to her. Her child. And they had memories of him that wasn't white supremacy. They had memories of sitting on the couch, talking, dancing, laughing. And these are the things I wanted people to hear.
And aside from Moose, is there another favorite character that you have in the play?
They did a rough cut of Kendra James. And they gave me that one. With so many people, I meet so many people, I can't keep track of everybody's name. But the young lady that did it was just, she was just awesome. Brought me to tears. I just met Kendra James' mother yesterday.
Shirley.
Yes, and I'm so sad that I didn't meet her before because I listened to her yesterday tell some stories about her daughter. It would have been so nice to have that incorporated in the play.
But you met a lot of the families, the other families you met through this
family circle. Did everyone that wanted to participate in the family circle that was in the Portland metro area. My next plan is to go to Detroit and Louisiana. I know people there. They have organizations there that can reach the other people. And then I can write about them. I want them to be able to see this play. Let them see what could be done for them.
Film this in a socially distant way. It's a really interesting experiment in theater to be able to do that. And you did it in collaboration with Open Signal. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
We had cameras all over the place, and they was at distance. Wasn't a crowd of people. One person at a time did their part. It was monologue, so it made it easy for everybody. This whole play was all volunteer, from the actors to Open Signal to the building we use. It's pretty much just giving people, bringing them alive. I have one character. It would seem like a love letter to their mother. One was sad because he was going through a mental health crisis, saying, I know his mother gonna cry. Come downtown and sit down in the park and see it on the Justice Center wall. That's where my first showing going to be, and then I'll put it on YouTube.
Okay, and we will definitely do a plug on Old Malt and its release.
Family members want to talk about their family members, so it was easy for them to talk to somebody who wanted to listen.
How did you record the stories?
A lot of it I kept in my head. Sometimes I would write things down, but most of it was in my head because I had to figure out how I was going to create it. So that's where I kept it at.
So you've also started the car caravan that goes from PCC, and clearly that's doing a lot of the same work of resisting police violence. Do you want to talk about that?
I was sitting over at a friend of mine's house, Jill Nicholson, and she was going through her phone, and she seen a car caravan in another state. And she said, "Donna, you want to do a car caravan?" And I said, "Yes." And that was the beginning. When we started, it was quite a few people. We felt kind of overwhelmed. So we put out feelers for somebody to help us with traffic control. And a lady named Adrienne came along, and she brought in her nephew, who was a motorcycle rider, and he helped keep things in order. And next thing you know, we had last Friday 13 motorcycles. We felt empowered the way they acted, directing traffic, blocking traffic. And we get out and we see people that come out and they run out with their signs saying, in solidarity. We get a few people that say things. We had a man that said, "All lives matter." Had a megaphone and I hollered out, "All lives can't matter until Black lives matter." He just shut up. We didn't have people run through the crowd. One of the reasons why we had the motorcycles and a traffic trading before we go is to keep ourselves safe and keep the other person safe. We had a car that wanted to bust through our caravan, and he ran through and he boomed another car. And I mean, if he had taken that moment and stood in solidarity with us, he wouldn't have been in a traffic accident.
Were you doing organizing work, political work, before this was killed?
Not really. I mean, I had a Facebook page. I see a Black person killed, I would post it. And I maybe have a comment, but nothing really serious like now. I really don't want to see somebody else join our club that nobody wants to be in. When I got in with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, one of the people that started it came to one of our visuals. And she pulled me aside and she stopped me with all these tears. That's all I did from the moment I found out he was dead until I seen that woman. And she said, "Do something. Don't just sit and cry." Mother, and what, she's 77? 77-year-old mother gets out. She actually was a person that marched with Martin Luther King back in Chicago. So for me and my mother get in the mood, we get our staplers and our glue, and we put it all over the neighborhood. This neighborhood is not as receptive of the flyers as the old neighborhood we lived in North Portland. North Portland, people took a moment, read the signs. Signs stayed up. Except in the area of the police station, they took them down.
You know, you hear a lot now, Black Lives Matter and the Portland protests have been hijacked by fringe elements or by white people. What would you say to that?
Personally, I don't care. They want to stop this. If you go through our caravan, you might find 5 Black people. The rest is white. This is a white city. You know, we won't be able to do anything without white. I love the sight of the Federal Building. I couldn't wait when I went through. I just filmed it. I thought it was beautiful. All the messages, letting people know. I love the ACAB. I love that. Every time I see a cop, when I'm on my megaphone, that's what I scream out. So I seen paintings all over the city of my grandson. I went down a neighborhood. And it was a beautiful neighborhood, and they had a little park going down the middle of the street. And on every tree, from one end to the other, had a list of Black names. You go around the other side, it had a list of Black names. I took the caravan that way. And as we go down, I was screaming out, "Say their name." And the people in there came out in solidarity. The more people stand up and be educated, because some people need to be educated. And we put things on our car sometime that is educational. And that's the major thing. The play, the caravan, Pacific Northwest Family Circles, when they out protesting, all of it is education. I stand by Black Lives Matter because it's this group of people who's fighting for their lives. But it's not just black lives that they're killing.
Yeah, you make me think about James Chassie.
Yeah, just beat that child.
The film Alien Boy, which really kind of captures that.
Yeah, just beat that child. But we got so many people that's just killed for no reason at all. If you got a person, like for instance, my grandson, who's working to do what you say, you telling him, raise your hand, crawl out, do these things. And
he was literally on his knees when he was shot.
Trying to do what they said, but it was too many voices coming at him. He was scared. He probably had his pants coming down. And Hearst killed him. And if people would read the public notice, Hearst knew him.
How did Hearst know him?
My grandson beat up one of his relatives at a fight. He was a kid. Okay, and Hearst knew him.
So he would have been 21 on August 2nd.
Yes. Another thing about him, and that was in the play also. He used to come to my mama's house every 2 weeks or so and sit in one chair. And my mother thought he was coming over to see her. We don't think so. He would sit there and hold the dog for an hour, 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. And the dog would sit right there on him. And when it was over, what did he tell God? Bye-bye, Gigi. The while when Qantas didn't come over, the dog walked through the house, head hanging down, didn't want to be bothered with nobody. So the dog grieved. That's the type of person he was, that he had a dog grieving. Moose, everything I do is because of him. Before I recognized the killing of people, it broke my heart, but I didn't reach out. And once it happened to me, I had no other choice but to reach out. My thing is, I don't want other people to have to join this crowd. Get out and fight before it happens to one of yours.
You've been listening to an interview with Donna Hayes, grandmother of 17-year-old Qantas Moose Hayes, who was killed by the Portland police in 2017. Her play, Silent Voices, which features the stories of 9 people who died at the hands of Portland police, was produced in collaboration with the Portland Playhouse and Open Signal. If you're interested in joining the car caravan, it meets on Wednesdays and Fridays in the parking lot of the Portland Community College Cascade campus near the Student Services Building at 6 p.m. The Friday protest will soon be moving to Saturday, so keep an eye out for that change. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Before there was Trayvon.
This song is dedicated to Deontay J. Keller, who was shot by Portland, Oregon police in 1996.
Before there was Trayvon.
And all the others across the country who have lost their lives in senseless violence.
License to kill, they get away with murder. Plant the evidence at the scene, throw away burner. They'll say they felt their life was in imminent danger. Another sister or brother slain by a stranger. Murder one of us every 28 hours. Undeclared warfare, that's white power. If you're indigenous or African American, they use the media to assassinate your character. For it to make sense, I'd have to be convinced they're predators amongst us with malevolent intent. I could have a confrontation at a moment's notice. Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Keaton Otis, James Perez, and Kendra James. Deontay Keller, too many names. Oscar Grant and Aaron Campbell. How we gonna set a different example?
January 29th, 2010, Aaron Campbell was shot in the back after being distraught from losing his brother earlier that day. Shot within 24 seconds after being stopped for failing to stop at a stop sign and driving in the car.
The state of the nation is pacifying the masses with sadistic tactics. Communities live in fear, wondering how many will die this year and how many more will remain silent in the face of violence. People hold their breath, knowing it's liberty or death. Headhunters decapitating movements, breaking nations into fragments, and race is said to be coincidence rather than evidence that the state of the nation is extermination. Blood of fathers, brothers, sisters, mothers staining America from Oakland to Providence. Forced silence, government-funded violence. Armed forces are targeting melanin once again, and homicide is justified when it's genocide. But how many more black folks are going to be crucified for the sins of America?
Before there was Trayvon.
Shot inside her car on the Skidmore Bridge by Portland Police.
Before there was Trayvon.
February 22nd, 2002. Byron Hammack Jr. was shot in Motel 6 after having a confrontation inside his motel room.
On February 28th, 1996, my son Deontay J. Keller was pulled over by Portland Police Officer Terry Krueger. Unfortunately, he jumped out the car and ran. Unbeknownst to him, a shot was fired, and he was shot in the back. But he continued to run, even though no shots fired call was called into the dispatch. Police found Deontay about three houses down in the backyard, lying face down, but he was still breathing. They handcuffed him and called for medical. Medical arrived at 2:23 a.m., but the police would not allow the medical to come in until 3:41. Within that time frame, Deontay
before
died.
There was Trayvon.
They could have saved Deontay if they would have allowed medical to come in.
Before there was Trayvon.
How much longer are we going to continue to go through this?
Before there was Trayvon.
That was Before There Was Trayvon, Mike Crenshaw, who's a recording artist here in Portland, also a political activist. And thanks to Donna Hayes for turning us on to that piece of music. It's part of their program with Silent Voices, the play that you just heard her talking with Desiree Hellegers about. We'll have more information on when this play will actually open in Portland. Of course, the pandemic will always have its say, but we'll hope for the best. We're closing today's program with a segment from the archive, June 2019. Our late, longtime old mole, Clayton Morgridge, reads this commentary based on Martin Hagelin's book, This Life, Secular Life and Spiritual Freedom. We'll turn now to Clayton Morgridge.
In this commentary, I'm going to be drawing on Martin Hagelin's book, This Life, Secular Life and Spiritual Freedom. If we had all the time in the world, if we were immortal, then it wouldn't matter how we spent our time, for there would always be more of it. But if life is short, then it matters a lot. If everything and everyone we care about is finite, if we and the people we love are mortal and can die at any moment and will die at some moment, then every day and every minute of our finite lives is supremely important. How then should we arrange our lives together so that the time of our lives is well spent? In view of our mortality, wouldn't we want to spend as much of our allotted time as possible doing things we want to do that are worth doing for their own sake, and to minimize the time we spend doing things we have to do? There is the realm of freedom and the realm of necessity. The realm of necessity is what we have to do, whether we want to or not. It includes the activities necessary for maintaining life, cleaning, caring for children, the ill, the injured, and the aged, building and maintaining dwellings and infrastructure, and growing and preparing food. All this belongs to the realm of necessity. Now, some people may enjoy this work, but it has to be done, whether we enjoy it or not. The realm of freedom, on the other hand, consists of the activities we choose to do, because they are valuable in themselves. Athletic activities, art, music, literature, science, and philosophy are examples. The realm of necessity is unavoidable in any society, stuff that has to be done regardless of whether anyone would choose to do it. There are different ways of getting people to do such work. The Greeks and the Romans built their empires with the power of people they enslaved. So did American capitalism. Thus, citizens, especially the elites, were free to engage in the arts, sciences, and of course politics. Then there are various ways of tying the lower classes to the land, as in feudalism and sharecropping, in which what peasants produce must be shared with the upper classes, again leaving the well-born with time to pursue what seemed to them most valuable, such as explaining why God wanted things to be this way. Does capitalism give us all the right to choose how we shall spend our time? Well, capitalism got its wealth in the first place by means of slavery in the U.S. and the Caribbean, rapacious colonialism in Africa and Central and South America, and the dispossession of native peoples in the U.S. and elsewhere. Wage labor, though, became the primary way for capital to make money. But although wage labor is called free labor, to set it apart from slavery, it is more perceptive to call it wage slavery. Whatever job we do for a wage becomes part of our realm of necessity, not only because we have to do it to stay alive, but because while we're at work, we are under the dictatorship of our employer. Even the owners and managers of capital, in spite of their wealth, are not free from the demands of capital, which requires them to grow their capital by ceaselessly competing for investment opportunities, more land, more resources, more labor, and more consumers to exploit. Where can you rest your eyes on things and activities that are not in some way exploited by capital? Like a cancer on the living earth, capital sucks everything, including the time of our lives, into its grasp, to the point that the survival of life, and certainly civilized life, is in question. Is there a way of organizing a society that would expand the realm of freedom and shrink the realm of necessity so that more of our time would be our own and not under control of others whose interests are opposed to our own? Let's consider democratic socialism as it is laid out in Three Principles by Martin Hegland in his book, This Life. First, we make it the purpose of our society to liberate our time from the realm of necessity, to expand the time in which we do what we, individually and collectively, choose to do. Second, the means of production, the goods and resources we need to maintain our lives together, must be owned and managed democratically, for otherwise we do not control the valuable time of our lives, as the first principle requires. The third principle is familiar. As W.E.B. Du Bois phrased it, the effort to give all people what they need and to ask of each the best they can contribute, this is the only way of human life. Unless we trust that our needs will be met, we cannot freely choose how to spend our time, and we cannot know that our needs will be met unless we cooperate in meeting these needs to the best of our ability. And what we need is not only what we have just to live, but also what we need to flourish, and flourish together. We need the means to develop our abilities to do the things we find satisfying, and the abilities to work together as citizens of a fully democratic society. Such a society will reduce and transform necessary labor in three ways. First, a great deal of necessary labor can be done in the realm of freedom, when we no longer have to worry about making a living by selling the time of our lives to others. Childcare, gardening, and architecture are socially necessary activities, but many people love to do them for their own sake and would do so in a free society. Second, the problem with unpleasant but necessary labor today is that those who do it because they need the money in order to survive. And that makes it hard to identify with the social purpose of what they are doing. In a cooperative society, socially necessary labor is shared by all members of society on the basis of their abilities and commitments, with the explicit purpose of contributing to a common good that everyone can recognize as making their lives better. Third, since we all participate in necessary labor, we will all have good reason to develop and deploy labor-saving technology, whose purpose now would not be to eliminate jobs that people need, but to decrease and enhance the quality of the time we spend doing things we have to do. In capitalist society, most people at some level feel alienated from a society in which so much of the short time we have to live must be given over to doing things that we do not choose to do. We cannot feel at home in a society that is governed economically and politically by forces unconcerned with our welfare. People do what they can to carve out a personal spot in this unfriendly space where they can feel more or less safe and comfortable, although many millions of us, some of whom you can see living on our streets, are unable to achieve even this. But very few of us feel any sense of owning or belonging to this society. Democratic socialism will be the first society that is truly of the people, by the people, and for the people. And only such a society has a shot at not perishing from the earth. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. Wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning on the Old Mole Variety Hour. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And I want to thank our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick, Lawrence Douglas, Larry Bolden, Patricia Kohlberg, Desiree Helligers, Donna Hayes, Mike Crenshaw for his music. We also heard music from Nina Simone. And we heard music from Angelique Kidjo. I highly recommend checking her out. And, of course, Clayton Morgeridge, as always, giving us a light in the dark.